Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Uprising of Women in Philanthropy show. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show based on this book by 10 women from around the world. You are listening to Incandescent TV or Incandescent Radio, and the Uprising is just a beautiful everything. So I'm going to throw it over to Miss Stephanie, who is a co-author, and she and Ruby Bright will be our guests today. So take it away, Steph.
Hi, thanks, Hope. And hi, everybody. Ruby Bright and I are both co-authors of the book, along with the other women around the world that Hope mentioned. And we formed a collaborative writing process to share our stories about how women as activists and donors are steadily using their resources of time and money to turn the world upside down, but in a good way, by enabling the realities of women's lives to guide funding strategy and priorities. So what a concept, the idea that money would be driven by what people really need, especially women. So co-writing the book has been a great way to get these stories on the record, both for the pride of understanding better how wide and deep the women's funding movement really is, along with the sheer joy of seeing up close how so many women are collaborating and sharing leadership to make a huge impact. My job today is to optimize the 30 minutes or so we have with you and to also share some good stories about how it all happened so far. Ruby is the 22-year and recently retired CEO of the Women's Foundation for Greater Memphis. You might think that sounds like a long career and maybe that 2 decades plus of leadership to an organization would require a cautious and careful leadership style, but not Ruby and not her donors, her volunteers, or community leaders. Nope. From day one, I think they just dove right into deep water. And Ruby and the foundation, I believe, have gone to the edges of Memphis where so many women's concerns are hidden. And they have broken barriers among the power brokers. They've partnered with girls and women to change economic equity, housing innovations, and to survive COVID. And they've multiplied the numbers and scale of women's philanthropy over and over again. So, Ruby, I'll turn it over to you for an intro and maybe a first story about your work.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Hope. It is a pleasure to be on this podcast with two dynamic women that a couple with the many, many women across the world who are focused on women and girls philanthropy. I am Ruby Bright, as Stephanie mentioned. I've had over 40 years in nonprofit, but the last 22 years of my professional career has been focused on the Women's Foundation and funding women and girls, women and children, and really helping to improve the lives of people living in poverty in Memphis. The organization is over 25 years, actually celebrating 30 years in 2026. And over that period, the investment has been directly focused on funding programs that help women and children reach their full potential. That is the mission of the organization. Over my period of time, the organization has raised over $33 million. Granted, I raised more, but granted more than $33 million in the community to over 582 programs and engaging leadership throughout the community. I think if I would share a story of how the Women's Foundation really got its wings, if you will, established in 1996. However, in 2003, the organization was invited in to be a part of a study of how to help bring help the city be awarded a HOPE 6 grant. If you remember, a HOPE 6 were community development grants. We were asked to make a recommendation. At that time, the board came together in less than 24 hours. Women came together and they, we talked about it, and one board member, the leader, said, "Why don't we raise this $1 million? The key to the Hope Six grant for our community was that the local community service support would have to be funded locally, meaning that you have to raise that money to demonstrate that you, the community, would embrace a Hope Six grant of $20 million for public housing development. The Women's Foundation took a unanimous vote that we would raise the $1 million. In less than 2 years, we had to raise another $11 million for the next community development. My point here is this is about collaboration, and Hope Six money helped us to establish Memphis Hope. Memphis Hope is now a trademark, and that is focused on helping low-income families, originally with public housing families, to become self-sufficient, to empower themselves, to help themselves, to help them be raised up and not to walk together and not be suppressed, and to empower them to write their own story of their lives. And I'm proud to say that we have eradicated concentrated public housing in our community.
Wow, that's amazing, Ruby. Do you think that such a defining project, especially as the housing project that you mentioned, that had some shock value in the community? I mean, did it wake people up about both the unseen problems and the potential for a women's fund? Did you have a sense of that?
Well, I think that there were several components, actually. Shock was one, which actually could be described in two ways. One, with the shock of even that we would even consider that we could help move communities forward was almost a laugh at some points. Philanthropy just said, "Your mission creeping, possibly, or is that, you know, that's not what you are, an intermediary. You make grants to community. How, why are you being involved?" The other shock, I think, was that we didn't give up, and we were persistent. We were very strong with what we wanted to do. I think the shock that within the Women's Foundation for Greater Memphis Board of Directors, we were able to get commitments of $1.2 million in one room from women leaders who did not necessarily see themselves as philanthropists. So the shock that we would want to make the community better, and that we wanted to lead that effort to reduce poverty in the poorest zip code in our community, was something that was embraced by the foundation, but we had to convince the community, both philanthropy and community support services, to partner with us.
That's so interesting. I actually was going to ask you a question about how women's giving in Memphis changed as a result of the visibility of the, all the projects of the foundation, but especially that big collaboration on housing. Is there anything else you could say about, you know, how women's giving changed, even the women's giving to the Memphis, the foundation for the Women's Foundation of Memphis?
Yes, it's giving, women were given the opportunity through our work to see themselves as part of the change in the future, part of the solution. And so we also decided to redefine philanthropy. Philanthropy was perceived as just for rich women and rich white women, especially. And this helped us to see that everyone could have a seat at the table, and that philanthropy is giving, and giving with intentionality. So it opened the door for more women to be able to give, and especially women of color. I mean, we probably had 15% of our donors who were women of color at the time. And I'm proud to say when I left, the percentage is 50-50, and we had a budget of less than $1 million at that time. And now with a budget of $5 million, you know, we have diversified our giving, and that every gift is important. Also, the leverage of giving is important, is that we work with public-private partnerships. And so we gave first, meaning women stood up and said we would give, you know, we would raise this amount if the city would provide this amount and if we could get federal funding for this amount. So it's a third, a third, a third kind of a concept that encouraged philanthropy. And philanthropy in the community saw us as good stewards, and they were converted to understanding that we had the process. We were on the ground with our grantee partners and could make a difference directly with the families. And that was important.
Great. Just hearing your story makes me realize that I think some people are going to think that we have overstated the importance of the women's funding movement by calling it an uprising in the book's title. But based on what you're saying and all that I know from the work I've done in women's funding, trust me, the women's funding movement has taken the fundamentals of how to make high impact using a public philanthropy structure and really pushed it to its limits and beyond in terms of, you know, how to engage so many people in the giving. I suppose there could have been a model where you would only go to the rich and ask for help for the poor, but that is not the principle that this movement is built on. It's built on everybody being a donor, everybody being part of the change. And I think that that is really, it really shows up in how you're describing Memphis. I think words like participation, trust, power sharing, sustainable social change, intersectionality, they're all part of the basic principles of how women's funds were established. And so women's funds are just magnets for these ideas and are proving every step of the way that it not only makes sense and that the value of money can be scaled up in size and intensity when you go to women living the problem to figure out how to solve it together and then put the problem solving, especially in their hands with the funds that everybody has put on the table. I think that's really great. And I've seen this mirrored in so many experiences. I've been a founder of several women's funds, and because of my foundation program officer role in the past and my consulting, I think I've probably worked directly with about 40 women's funds, a lot in the US, but also internationally. And this experience is just mirrored over and over and over again. The value base of these funds is just really strong. And that's why the change shows up in what I called, you know, in the title, a financial system that is being turned upside down. So I just wanted to throw in a story. I live in Iowa now, and I'm a founder of the Iowa Women's Foundation. And among many other things that I do and give to the foundation, I've helped with pro bono time to do the strategic planning and organizational development for the Women's Foundation over quite a few years. And as part of that, of a strategic planning process about 6, maybe 7 years ago, the foundation took a year as part of their plan to travel around the state and to learn more about the barriers to equality for women and girls in Iowa. It's like, what is really holding people back in this state, especially our women and girls? So no surprise. Big issues like employment and education were at the top of the list, but so were transportation and mentoring, and then childcare. And when the foundation leaders returned to the communities to report the research, that they had gathered from about 17 communities. They held meetings and asked each community to pick the one barrier that they thought was the most significant and the one that needed to be worked on most urgently. And community after community put childcare in first place. Even in the towns and small cities in Iowa, the shortages of childcare were enormous. Thousands of places for children were missing in the childcare system, which, like most states, is complex with, you know, mostly private, at home, in institutions, et cetera. But instead of a traditional grant-making program announcing a call for applications for funding, the foundation went back again to each community to assess and then organize the community's resources and talk to the leaders about starting up their own effort in that community. And within about a year, almost all the communities had managed to raise public-private partner resources. And a lot, like you were mentioning, Ruby, the shares were sort of put on the table from local government, from corporations in the communities, and just in private individuals. Within another year, childcare centers were opening in all these communities. And now the Women's Fund is both working and sort of monitoring legislation to help with the provision of childcare in Iowa, and also helping each state manage to keep its own project on track. The foundation also raised quite a bit of money to give seed grants and to help the communities when they needed some glue in the process. But amazingly, this local conversation and dialogue process really put the whole project in the hands of people in the states. No one funder controls this new initiative on childcare. It's a pretty exciting story. So I'm going to turn it back to you, Ruby, for maybe another story that helps to pull out some of these success factors. But it might be interesting for everybody listening to hear you talk a little bit about what barriers you all had to kick out of the way in order to get the success you had.
Thank you, Stephanie, and I appreciate your story. As you were sharing that, it reminded me, you know, of several. And I mentioned earlier that we started our efforts towards community revitalization in partnership with Memphis Housing Authority, the City of Memphis, and the greater community. And I was, you know, we wanted to help women and children. So 80% of public housing, actually more than that, 90% public housing was a single female headed household. 85% were women of color. And so where does poverty lie? We looked at our study that was conducted in 1996, went back and recognized that the poverty level had not changed in that amount of time, in more than a decade. So what are the conditions of these families that, although they're getting help, that they can't seem to move themselves forward? How do you propel forward? And so we decided to focus our efforts in a single zip code and start with the poorest zip code or the most impoverished zip code in Memphis, Tennessee. And that zip code was 38126. Our initiatives and our work was focused on reducing poverty. And, you know, we had a Vision 2020 plan to reduce poverty by 5%, 1% a year, or the average of over 5% in 5 years. That initiative, we had to, you know, monetize what it would take to make that happen. And remember, I mean, when we talk about millions, to say that it will take, you know, 20 million, that was huge for Memphis. I mean, you know, huge to think that we could raise that kind of money, particularly in an organization whom at the time, did not have, as I said, a $1 million budget annually. So we saw that as an opportunity. But what did we know about it? Okay, what do we know about these communities and the families that live there? And that's where I think the beauty of the women's funding movement and how we go about our work actually works for us. Because we decided, why should we decide what we should be doing? What we need to do is ask what they need. And so we held focus groups. Well, we went into the community, and I will tell you, barrier is that who do we think we were pretty much told, who do we think we are coming in to the community with our fine suits, fine shoes, and, education professionals and all of that? Why do we think that we can help these women? And they were very honest with us that they didn't trust was not there. What did we have invested in? Why did we care? And if we cared, we would address some of their immediate needs. And so we asked what those were. And, what I think we got from that was really amazing is they just wanted trust and respect first. How can I trust you? Will you respect me? You're asking me to tell my story. And, I will never forget one lady. She was very vocal. She was not going to move out of the community. She was the last one to move out of public housing. She staged herself. She picketed in front of her house. She was saying, this is my home. I've been here. I'm a public housing product for 30 years or more, and I'm going to stay here. This is my home. You can't make me move. Y'all come up with things all the time, so I'm just going to wait it out. In this particular case, that wasn't the case. She was either going to have to move out or she was going to have to be removed, and we did not want the latter. I went and sat with her in front of her signs. She had tables and flyers, and asked her, what does she want most? She said, I worry about my children, and I don't know that I did a good job. But now I have another chance. It's with my grandchildren. They need me. And I want them to not have to live like this. I accept my life and I accept my mistakes, but I want them to have a better life. And as we started to talk about that, I was able to share with her what I wanted for my kids. The same thing, what the challenges are for, community. And I could see the barriers being broken at that point. I could see her leaning in. I did not want to abuse that and just ask more questions, ask could she pull together a few women that maybe could share more insight. And she said, with conditions, she decided where they needed to meet and, everything in a way that was comfortable for them. And we did that, and we actually established the Women of Memphis Hope. They then became advocates in the community after we talked with them and helped them with, whether they wanted to. It was financial assistance, the access to health care, the opportunity to get their children back in school. School uniforms, school supplies, basic things. And I will say this, they never, ever ask for themselves. That, what can we do for, I will be fine, because if I can have my housing, if I can have a roof over my head and safety for my children, food for them to eat, and their ability to be able to attend school on a regular basis, mothers had to decide sometimes whether they were the high school student was going to get to go to school in the winter or the youngest. Because if they were going to earn money, somebody had to stay home. So they, you know, or this month they get shoes. Next month they get clothes. And these are real life circumstances. Or neighbors sharing their electricity. Extension cords across apartments. How do we create the change so that they can be comfortable with that and not be marginalized because of? So the barrier is the opportunity to open doors. The other is, how do you save the respect and how do you save the integrity of an individual? And, you know, we're proud, and Black women are very, very protective. So how do we create that with philanthropy? We did not go with what was less as much as where the opportunity to create change by being a part of a partnership that really wants to make social change and empower women to empower themselves. We did not reduce ourselves to compromise that. And we learned that from the people that we were trying to help, the women we were trying to assist. So, you know, for me, that story is very important. And I grew up in rural Mississippi. And we had our basic means. It's kind of like we didn't know we were poor because we had the basics of what we were needed. But yet at the same time, when we started to look, broadly, we recognized that many of the gifts that we were given, the ability for my grandparents to raise their own food, use the land to be an asset. And so when we start to think about what are assets when we are helping women to be empowered to move forward, that's the base where we start. And, when we, Memphis, helped with the Katrina work, we started from, what do you need with these families? They were confused. The important part about that is that we said, let's think about this. Philanthropy was all over Katrina, all over. I mean, people, how can we help? We just failed to ask the people first. Based on our experience, that's what we did. And from that, we were able to create an intake form. You know, the most important thing that they wanted was access to their families across the country, finding out where their families are. Where can I get meds for my mother who's diabetic? Where can I have shelter for someone who cannot go into just an open shelter and a gym? How do I get dialysis for my family? But the most important thing was, what do you want? What do you need? And I think that women's fund movements and women's foundations around the country, women's organizations, we are sensitive to that. And I also feel like that women of color leading really makes a difference in communities where there's a large percentage of people of color. And that's here in Memphis.
Those breakthroughs just seem enormous. And I couldn't help thinking about the part of the values and the principle, and really part of the uprising in that Women's Funds have created, has been also the idea of not only making that breakthrough at the front lines where the women are in the midst of the problems that need to be solved, but also giving that same kind of gentleness, maybe, as well as kind of passionate focus to the donors as well as the problem solvers. And some people are both, but some people may stay one side or the other in a particular set of issues. And I know from the experience, and it's something that we write a bit about in the book, is that the journey of donors is also driven by this sense of personal, some sort of personal transformation that's taken place in their life, or a barrier that's been put in front of people that they suddenly perceive as unfair, or they realize it's not right somehow. So even with people who have the privilege of financial resources or good jobs or whatever, for many women, there have been these instances in life where there's just this wound somehow that makes them then start believing deeper and deeper and deeper in the cause of equity for women. And so again, in the same way that my experience about, you know, growing the organizations has been ratified, so to speak, by so many women's funds that I've worked with, the same has been true for working with women donors, and that sense that they are propelled. They are propelled towards bigger giving. It's how we've moved women into $1 million and $1 million plus gifts, is also that listening and the processing and the allowing and enabling people to speak out loud about what it is that has the barrier that was in their way or is still in their way that they need to resolve and they want other women to resolve as well. So I did want to ask you, in this whole process, as you were learning so much from the women in the front lines, what did you also learn, or maybe what was your biggest lesson that you learned from the donors who are partnering with you?
Thank you for that. As you were speaking again, I'm remembering a couple of things. Is that, you know, where are those bold opportunities, and how they come about? And, you know, I think that donors, what the women's movement across the country in Memphis benefited from it, women leaders in large philanthropy nationally, we were able to bring national funding into our community. And I don't think that that would have been introduced had it not been for the Women's Funding Network, you know, the engagement of women's funds across the country, the connection. We're sharers, we're givers, you know, we learn something, and then we share that learning, and we pass it on and pass it on. What we were able to do was also help funders come in together in a collaborative manner to support initiatives that were women, women's foundation, women's funds, women leader led to get better outcomes, and to measure impact. Data has consistently been important, but what we're able to do is match data with facts and stories. We humanize data. And we can name it and claim it. We build relationships, whether they're frontline or across the country. I mean, when I think about Prosperity Together, Stephanie, and our bold commitment, 29 organizations, 29 women foundations said, we will raise $100 million in 5 years. And at that time, it was said to be impossible that we would raise and invest. Not, I said raise, but we would invest $100 million. Do you remember that, Stephanie? And we stood on the White House steps in Washington, D.C., and made that declaration. I mean, we had organizations, you know, supporting us, and women with, you know, Ms. Foundation and many others that helped to lead that effort. And we were boldly standing. I remember Ana Oliveira saying to me, we were standing there together, and she said, well, when you do it like this, you got to get it done, right? So we roll up our sleeves and make it happen. I think that we look from opportunity, not a barrier is how do we address this issue? we don't let that barrier stand in the way. And when you do this work for so many years, the next component of that is advocacy. We got to protect what the investment has been. And then how do you pass it on to young girls? Thus, the Young Women's Initiative was established. It's kind of like we keep moving and moving it in motion. And I think now we've really got to challenge ourselves to say, how do we elevate women's leadership and move to policy change and impact by building stronger, better?
Yeah, that's the big question. But I wanted to follow that up with a little story that I heard from one of my donors that was in a workshop that I was giving on really propelling and pushing women's giving to a new scale. And she had recently gone through this process herself. And she said, oh, yeah, women's funds are so good at helping us see more realistically what we could really give as opposed to what we're afraid to give or what we think we can give. And she said, I think that it's really a good thing when your hand shakes as you write the biggest check you're capable of writing. And it's going to go into the Women's Fund and for these frontline causes. And I've always thought of that. And I thought, gosh, when I'm giving a contribution, is my hand shaking or isn't it? And if it isn't shaking, should I be thinking about whether or not the organization is a higher priority or whether it's okay to just give a little something that doesn't make my hand shake? So I think that, you know, those, you know, what makes our hands shake as we write the check, but also what shakes the steps of the White House? You know, what is it? How much do we have to do? And I remember that project and feeling so proud of that work. So I thought just we should take a few minutes, maybe just to think about how we think a reader could enjoy this book and use the book, perhaps. We know how wonderful it is. We resonate with all the stories, but what if somebody orders it and thinks it should be in their quote unquote library and there it sits? What can we say or what can you think of that would help somebody want to just pull it off the shelf and read it cover to cover? Any ideas?
Well, I can think of many reasons, but I will tell you first mine. I was motivated to be a part of this book. As you know, it was a 5-year plus project for us. And I think that we probably spent most of the four years thinking about the title. But because we had so much to say and figuring out how we were going to do that. But I was motivated by the fact that having been in this work over 2 decades, and having 3 granddaughters, I was motivated that this book would be a gift that I would be able to leave as a legacy for them, and that it was a book that they could pull off the shelf to share any information or to learn about how they can be philanthropists, you know, in their community. It's a book that I think young people, we need to get it out to young people. And we don't want it on the shelves. We want it, you know, in the classroom. We want it at lectures. I mean, you know, this is a book is one that can help in so many ways, so many women and girls propel themselves towards creating social change, expanding, giving, being philanthropists and really respecting that. Will share this story that one of the ladies on the front line, her first gift to the foundation was 50 cents. It was at a luncheon, and she said, you know, she was compelled that we said that anyone can give. And so she handed it to me because she did not want it to be lost. And she just wanted me to know that that's the most that she could give. She went on and she achieved a lot. The point here is that her last gift was $1,000. She gives annually. She asks others to give. She volunteers her time and train on Ruby Payne's work, getting ahead in a goodbye world that she got the certification for. So philanthropy is not just the money. It is the time. We talk about the time, talent, and intellectual capital. And I think that women's leaders and women's foundations, our creativity, our connection to build philanthropy together is very unique. And this book will be one that can be used in so many ways. It is a reference and a reminder of why and how. It is an insightful opportunity to imagine what next. And it has the foundation that is unshakable about women and its leadership and philanthropy together.
Well, I would say for me, if I were going to answer my own question, I would say that it's all that you just said. And the only thing that I would add in is that I think the book is juicy. I mean, who even knew? Most people don't even know there's such a thing as women defenders of human rights and how important it is to safeguard those defenders, get them the training they need. How many people would believe if we were just sitting around with a casual group of neighborhood friends, how many of them would believe that women with help from a women's fund shut down a government and, you know, created a new one, or helped to end a war and helped to define rape and sex crimes as part of acts of war? I mean, how many people would believe how, you know, much got done in Memphis in terms that you actually built housing? I mean, every story in this book to me is just, I don't know, juicy is my best word, because it's just like, this is not dry, you know, soulless work. Even sometimes when you have to use the jargon of philanthropy, it is downright life changing. And I hope that everybody takes the book off the shelf, learns everything that you talked about, and also gets the emotional messages that we're both talking about. And I think that unless you have a last word that you'd like to throw in for the audience, I think that just about wraps us up.
So I think that, Stephanie, thank you. And Hope, thank you for this opportunity as well. What I would leave is, what you don't know, you don't know. This book is for you. You will pass it on, and we will build a greater future because women and women's philanthropy will be recognized, accepted, and propelled forward.
Beautiful, beautifully said. I always want to cry at the end of these interviews because it's so important. It's so powerful. And my PR brain is thinking, how do we really get this out to more and more and more people? So we're going to keep talking about that. And dear readers and listeners, you or watchers and listeners, viewers, you are listening and watching The Uprising of Women in Philanthropy, a beautiful, amazing, very powerful and important book as we move into 2025. It is available for sale, of course, and you can learn all about it at uprisingofwomeninphilanthropy.com. And we're also on LinkedIn. Just follow that title. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of this show. We look forward to your questions and sharing more information about The Uprising of Women in Philanthropy. We'll see you all soon. Happy New Year. Thank you, Stephanie and Ruby. We'll talk to you all soon.
Thank you.